Up next is the Old Mole Variety Hour. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Merrillhurst University's new Bachelor of Arts in Media and Film Studies.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
And good morning. This is KBOO, listener-supported community radio, where it's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. The mole is the beast that works in the dark to let in the light by digging among the roots of this confusing world we live in to lay bare the foundations of exploitation that are at the bottom of the inequality and injustice that bedevils our lives. I'm your host for today, Clayton Morgridge. Joe Clement is our engineer. On today's show, we're going to be hearing from Robert McChesney about how the internet is falling increasingly under the control of a few big corporations, giving them the power to shape political discourse in their own interests. Our movie moles will be telling us about a new documentary about the place of hunger in the United States. It's called A Place at the Table. And I'll be talking with the Old Mole's radical musicologist about the soul music of the 1960s that aligned itself with the Black Power movement. Right now, here's a sample of that soul music we'll be hearing about and actually hearing. This is Nina Simone singing, I Wish I Knew What It Would Be Like to Be Free.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear.
And the Old Mole is all about breaking the chains that hold us and keep us apart, and about saying what needs to be said loudly and clearly. Now, here to talk about the role of the internet in saying what needs to be said is Bill Resnick to talk with Bob McChesney.
Bob McChesney, welcome to KABU.
Pleasure to be here, Bill.
Bob McChesney is a scholar and activist. He co-founded the organization Free Press. He has also written some of the most penetrating histories of media in the 20th century, exploring how the many emerging media, newspapers, movies, radio, TV, they all began with such democratic promise. Ultimately, after considerable struggle, they came to be dominated by private business interests. His most recent book, Digital Disconnect, How Capital is Turning the Internet Against Democracy, that book examines today's struggles over the internet. Will the popular movements, including Free Press, be able to build and construct a relatively free and democratic internet, as well as the rest of the growing sphere of digital communications? Bob, tell us about your book, why you wrote it, the growing significance and impact of digital communications, and introduce us to the struggles for control now underway.
I began working on the internet probably 20 years ago when the World Wide Web made it become a ubiquitous mass medium. It's something I've studied and I've written about in articles and chapters, but I've never felt comfortable that we were at a point where it had crystallized enough that I could possibly write an authoritative book. And I think in the last 3 years, we've really gotten to the point where it has crystallized. There are dominant players, institutions, practices, laws in place that are not going anywhere for a while. There's going to be certainly great change on the horizon. But I think we're now at sort of a base camp most of the way up the mountain that we can see where we're heading and where we've come from in a manner that would have been impossible 5 years ago. So that's why I wrote this book now. And make the argument, in effect, that what's taken place is that we've seen the profit motive and commercial values take over and dominate the internet in ways that have really undermined much of the great promise of the technology. And that people still think of as the great promise of technology, the equalizing effect, the opening up of more competitive markets, the empowering of people with access to information and to work together in a collaborative manner, all wonderful things. But I think that if we look at the track record of the internet, what we see over and over now is increasingly that it's dominated by a handful of enormous corporations that work very closely with the government, many of which, like Google and Apple and Amazon and AT&T, have monopolistic control of markets very close to, if not exceeding, what John D. Rockefeller had with Standard Oil. And they're the dominant corporations in the entire economy. 13 of the 30 largest firms in the United States, publicly traded firms, are Internet-related companies. And to give a sense of how much power that is, only two of the top 30 firms are the too-big-to-fail banks. So this is really where the power is in our political economy. And what I do in the book, Bill, is I go through the fact that there's a number of crucial policy fights that are going on now that are coming up that are going to be the future of the Internet, are going to determine which way we go. These range from breaking up the cartel, which has monopolistic power over Internet access right now, the cell phone companies and the cable phone, the cable companies that control ISP. It includes battles over privacy, which is really the Achilles heel of the Internet model for Facebook and for Google and these companies, because they depend so much on ending any notion of privacy. We also have major fights over things like intellectual property, copyright, that have become just a noose around the neck of so many people trying to go online. And then also, in a long part of the book, talks about the fact that journalism, as we've come to know it in the United States, is disintegrated, not caused by the Internet, but accelerated by the Internet. And if we're serious about self-government, if we're serious about journalism, we're going to have a public policy solution to it, or the future is quite bleak.
Bob, is net neutrality and monopolization and the possibilities of major commercial enterprises just completely monetizing the Internet and taking it over, basically eliminating dissident voices from the possibility of access to audiences or even to one another? How do you see that playing out?
Well, Chapter 4 in the book goes in some detail through what I call the cartel. And one of the ironies of the Internet is that when it began in the 1990s, there was a whole flurry of hundreds of companies that became Internet service providers, ISPs. And it was a very competitive market, competing to offer Internet access to people at the lowest possible prices. And they all had access at the same rate to the phone lines. They could use AT&T's lines or any of the phone company's lines, since they were government-created monopolies. And it worked actually quite well. Well, unfortunately, due to corruption, what has happened is that the huge phone companies, and there are really only like two or three left, and the cable companies, there's only a couple left of them after all the mergers, have changed the rules so that they're the only ones who are allowed to use their wires. There's no longer any competition. And we've had AT&T and Verizon on one hand and Comcast on the other hand effectively divide up Internet access for the cell phone and cable companies so that there's only a few players, and they no longer really compete with each other. At least they don't compete in the sense that economists think of when they talk about competition. And it means what's happened in the United States is that 15 years ago, we were in the top two or three among all nations in the world in terms of speed, cost, access of Internet. I mean, we were the state of the art for Internet access for the world. Today, the United States ranks, you know, between 15 and 30 on all the measures, and we're falling. We pay much more in the United States for much crappier broadband service, much crappier cell phone service than people do in virtually all other industrial nations. And it's due exclusively the fact that these monopolists have no incentive to build out their network. They can just keep using their crappy networks, and they can charge us to the teeth because of their market power. And they have that market power because they own the politicians. So this is one of the core fights we have, this parasitic industry of people who basically control the bottleneck to access to the Internet that do nothing of value except gouge us. And so that's one of the big fights. And the reason why net neutrality becomes a big fight is that because there is no competition, effective choices in Internet access, we have to regulate them so that they don't discriminate against websites and users and services. If we had a competitive market, that wouldn't be an issue because no one would go to an ISP if it censored websites. But now you don't really have a choice. So we've got to force them not to censor websites. It's one of the big political fights we've had for the last 5 or 6 years. We haven't won it. Rhetorically, we've won it. The politicians say they're for it. But the Obama administration 2 years ago, when its FCC finally laid out a net neutrality policy, insisted on net neutrality for the cable companies, but not for the cell phone companies. So it's a Swiss cheese net neutrality for the cell phone companies who can basically privatize the Internet. And it's only a matter of time that that becomes the rule for the cable companies, because they'll say, hey, it's not fair that we have to play by a different standard than the cell phone companies.
Yeah. This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Bob McChesney about his latest book, Digital Disconnect, How Capital is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. We've been talking about, initially, one of the great issues is the cartelization of the internet. Bob, even if we had a lot of internet carriers, it seems to me that net neutrality, that is, that they couldn't discriminate against KBOO, for example, and make it very expensive for us even to have a site, or Google couldn't set up a set of algorithms that would ensure that only corporate-sponsored websites would appear in their first 30 if you do a search on some issue. That's fundamental. What are the various organizations that are fighting for net neutrality who seem to have won the battle, at least rhetorically and with the public, but on the inside, it's real questionable whether we can maintain sort of access and being able to have our voices heard. Is that enforceable, in fact, against these people and their sort of secret algorithms or search engines?
Well, we're mixing apples and oranges here, Bill, because when we talk about Google and its algorithms for search, that's different from the ISPs and what they're doing in net neutrality. We can certainly enforce net neutrality. That's not a problem. The problem is having a good policy to be enforced. So let's put that aside. As for Google, you raise a really important question. Google has immense market power and immense control. And I think we have a fundamental question to raise about a Google and a Facebook. These are what economists call natural monopolies. And the Internet is filled with them. It creates them. And basically the reason is that in network economics, the largest player gets much more attractive the larger it gets and gets much more effective. That's why Amazon's the only bookseller of note, and Google and Facebook and Twitter. And as a result, there's no competition. They become monopolies. And in economic terms, when you have a natural monopoly, you have three choices. One is to let it do whatever it wants to do and make a lot of money and probably do a lot of antisocial stuff because it can get away with it and make more money. Secondly, is to heavily regulate it like we tried to do with AT&T and the phone monopoly for 100 years in the 20th century. And then third is to make it a public trust, a nonprofit, non-commercial institution that's run democratically or publicly in some manner. Those are the three options. And in our society right now, with Google, with Facebook, with all these natural monopolies, Amazon, option A is what works. They basically, it's free-range Gilded Age. They've got a monopoly. No one can compete with them. And they can do whatever the heck they want, and they own all the politicians. So they don't have to worry about privacy, antitrust, taxes, the works. I think we've got to expand it so B and C get into the picture. We start having that debate. And even for people who say, wait, I love Google. I don't want to mess with Google. I love Amazon. I don't want to mess with Amazon. If those companies have the fear of B and C, if they have the fear that the public might take away their monopoly privileges, they'll start acting a lot nicer.
And to instill that fear, of course, is going to require a popular movement. One final issue that I'd like to talk about that you raise in the book is the Internet and all digital communications, it seems to me. How can they be now shaped if in fact, those movements grew strong enough to promote better quality, far more investigative journalism, and even support for newspapers and books and radio stations, all of those other media that are so important that are now being decimated and weakened by loss of audience to the Internet? How does the Internet, in fact, become a supporter of a really rich and free media rather than the gravedigger of it?
Well, the Internet didn't cause the crisis in media and journalism, but it greatly accelerated it to no small extent because advertising, which has subsidized much of our media and nearly all of our journalism for the last 125 years, has got new alternatives on the Internet that don't require any longer supporting news media or journalism. And in fact, the bigger story is that the way advertising is rapidly changing online, it doesn't have to support any media content whatsoever, and it doesn't. And what this points us to is we have to stand naked before the truth, which is that journalism and media content more generally, but especially journalism, is a public good. It's something the market cannot provide efficient quality or quantity, not a journalism that serves the entire population. It's not just for elites. And this was masked by the role of advertising for the last 125 years to subsidize journalism. Now that advertising's out the window, we stand there and we can see there are no resources left. And since it's a public good, it needs to be solved like a public good, which means we need to have public money to create an independent, uncensored, competitive, nonprofit, non-commercial news media system so that a city like Portland has multiple newsrooms like KBOO and under different structures of control that are competing to cover the community. And until we have that, we aren't going to have the Internet really solve the problem, because doing journalism requires resources. It requires people who get paid to do it. It requires enough muscle that you scare people in power. And an unpaid person doing their own thing on their own when they have some free time doesn't scare anyone in power.
Bob, tell us about the organizations that can make a difference now, build that different model of journalism and of communication media.
Well, there's a lot of people working on these issues, but I mean, the biggest problem we have right now is that we need to get all the groups who are loosely interested in having a more fair, just, democratic, and humane society have to understand these issues have to be central to what they work on. And regrettably, we're getting there slowly, but we need to pick up the pace. Right now, probably the leading group that works on all the issues I talk about in the book is Free Press, the group that I helped co-found with John Nichols, and I'm on the board of it still. I'm no longer an officer, and I've never gotten a penny from it, so I have no personal stake in the group's success. But the group has been exceptionally good at organizing on these issues, but it has a long way to go. And I think one of the lessons of the book is that, you know, we're fighting, as I said, the largest corporations in America that have monopoly power and making a ton of money on it. And we're fighting them with a pea shooter right now. They basically own the board. They own both parties. They really dominate. We have our work cut out for us. We need to use a cliche, we need all hands on deck or we're not going to win.
Yeah, it clearly has to be part of a mass political movement. Not even the groups themselves will be always on the defensive until, in fact, we build that movement.
Well, that's absolutely right. In fact, that's one of the arguments I make in the book.
Bob McChesney, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Bill, it's my great pleasure. Everyone in Portland, I love you. Support KBOO and keep this station going strong.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody out there!
Get into it!
Everybody around there!
Get involved!
Everybody, you! Come on! Come on! Come on! Come on! Come on with your come on! Come on! Come on!
And that's James Brown's Get Up, Get Into It, and Get Involved here on KBOO's Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgridge, and I'll be talking with Brad Duncan, our radical musicologist, later in the show about this soul music and the politics that comes out of it. Now, here in our studio are our movie moles, Fran Michel and Denise Morris, to tell us about A Place at the Table, a new film about folks who don't know where their next meal is coming from. Take it away, movie moles.
Good morning. This is Fran Michel here with Denise Morris to discuss A Place at the Table, currently playing at the Hollywood Theater. Directed by Christy Jacobson and Laurie Silverbush, the film was partly funded by Participant Media, the social issue film folks, also behind the anti-teacher Waiting for Superman and the agribusiness expose Food, Inc. A Place at the Table addresses the problem of hunger in the USA, food insecurity in the USA, profiling three Americans dealing with food insecurity, a Colorado fifth grader named Rosie, a Mississippi second grader named Tramonica, and a Philadelphia single mother of two named Barbie Izquierda. The film also includes segments from interviews with researchers, advocates, and policymakers, including Marion Nestle, Raj Patel, Jeff Bridges, Top Shelf, Tom Colicchio, and a number of others. And it provides information about a variety of programs, federal and local, legislative and voluntary. The film offers some history, some facts, some analysis. The issue is important. The individual portraits compelling. The analysis is somewhat disappointing.
It is, Fran, and this is the point where moles will be moles. We will probably do this morning what we think we do best, and that is to kind of sort out what the underlying thinking and kind of motivations are in this film, the ideological center of it. One of the things that I think is important about understanding this film is that I think there's a difference between a systemic analysis and a system analysis. And I think the film has a system analysis more than it has a systemic analysis. It really points to the failures of the system, government programs and the like, and legislators to do the right thing. To provide for people, that system is is central as the problem and also the solution to the problem throughout the film. And the filmmakers actually look back to the 1968 film Hunger in America as kind of their own ray of hope, because that film, when it came out, really galvanized people, and there was enough pressure put on Congress to actually pass legislation with the kind of historical belief that hunger was eradicated for the most part by the end of the 70s through a number of programs that some of them barely survive today, others are lost.
Yeah, and the film is clear on saying that charity and volunteerism is not cutting it, is not enough, is not providing for people's needs, that those are systems that were set in place for emergencies, and if it's continuing for 40 years, it's no longer, you know, just a moment of crisis. It's an ongoing issue that has to be addressed in a broader way. But then they don't, you know, the only solutions they have really are a sort of Keynesianism, greater social spending, and they acknowledge that there have been, right, a lot more spending on the bank bailout and cuts to taxes for the most wealthy, as well as cuts in social spending. They don't look at any other kinds of alternatives or solutions. I mean, they don't, for instance, mention that in the 70s, in the 60s and 70s, and even as these programs that they're touting were coming into place and being built up, for instance, in California, the Black Panthers were feeding more kids than the California government was. And that's a statistic that's not in the film, but that Raj Patel mentions in Stuffed and Starved. And so, I mean, this is information that they had access to, but they don't include in the film. And they don't address the fact that hunger in America in 1968, that's a very different historical moment. And it's not just people writing to their legislators because they've seen one movie. It's because there's a whole wave of social movements in place and actively addressing issues in this country. And, I mean, the government is responding because they don't want people to overthrow the government, essentially.
Right. As they do. Yes. You know, there are a couple of tantalizing moments in the film if one is looking for a systemic analysis. Raj Patel is one particular talking head that gets quoted in the film many times. And he actually points to this question, or what is the question? Is it a question of insufficient food? No, it's a question of poverty, which then forces us to ask other questions like, what are the power dynamics? What are the class dynamics? How does exploitation happen in this country? And yes, it does. And also, it is Mariana Chilton, who actually starts Witnesses to Hunger, the group that then goes to Washington and involves some of the folks who were part of the film, taking part of the film to testify. She talks about living wage jobs, but when I say talks about it, it's mentioned, but that in of itself isn't talked about much at all. In fact, there would be lots to talk about. What do living wage jobs mean? And in fact, those ideas kind of die on the vine, so to speak, mm-hmm. and don't really get as much attention, or, I mean, a fraction of the attention that this hopefulness and this desire for the government to do the right thing gets.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of people say a lot of things in the course of the film which don't necessarily add up, and the filmmakers don't seem to clearly adjudicate among them. So, for instance, on the one hand, we have Mariana Chilton saying that people need living wage jobs, and we do see Barbie Izquierda at one point. She gets a job, and she's so excited, and she's so happy that now she has a job, and then we come back to her 3 months later, and it turns out she's in worse shape financially and having more trouble feeding her kids because the job that she's gotten, ironically enough, with an agency helping direct people to resources for food insecurity, doesn't pay her enough to feed her kids, and she's now ineligible for the SNAP program. So we get a sense of the need for, right, living wage jobs, for instance. But then we also get a little moment of someone talking about couple of people talking about the importance of education. And if you just show kids a honeydew melon, then they'll want to eat that instead of chips, you know. And there's this little scene in a classroom where these kids are shown a honeydew melon and they get to taste it, and it's so yummy. But nobody goes back to mention the fact that it should be clear from context that, like, these kids can't afford to buy honeydew melons, even if they could find them at the stores that are accessible to them. Because the film does mention food deserts and the problem of access to food.
Right. And in that, then, as we go from access and the question of what kinds of foods are available and affordable, we have this unsavory, if I can use that in a non-pun-like way, relating of obesity, poverty, and lack of nutrition, unhealthy bodies. And I think very importantly pointed out by the website Racialicious in their review, racialized. So the film's demographic is rural white poverty, urban brown, and primarily women. One of the things I do want to mention in that, however, is that there are moments where the filmmakers do, through their commentators, try to address the kind of the thinking that we have in America that if one is hungry and one is poor, that is the fault or the failings of individuals. And that, I think, also sort of dies on the vine and doesn't get rolled into what could then be connected to Raj Patel's ideas around systemic problems of poverty, that they're related to inequality and lack of access and opportunity, et cetera.
Yeah, and that's a great point. I mean, the film, you know, raises a lot of good points along with some not so good ones, like the importance of good nutrition to national security, which is an effective argument. It was used in putting in place the school lunch program in 1946 as a matter of national security, but it's perhaps not the argument one would like to see front and center, although there is no mention of the problem of public funding being diverted to spending on wars.
Not another very point directly. That doesn't come up. Yeah, it's very interesting that that doesn't happen, although there is then this other contradiction brought out. When it's the Child Nutrition Act or something, they're trying to get more funding for school lunch programs, and the money ends up coming from food stamps.
Yeah.
So we have what then becomes exceptional victims, children, and the adults, of course, can suffer the consequences of their poor choices.
Yeah. Yeah. So the structure of the film doesn't always follow up on some of the promising ideas it has, which it makes a lot of really good points. It makes some not so good points. It notes that you can be fat and hungry at the same time. It doesn't note that, in fact, notes the opposite of the fact that it's not the case that to be fat is necessarily to be unhealthy, which is a common misconception. It doesn't note the extent to which care work and feeding children and feeding adults is work that falls as a burden on women. But there were certainly things that we liked about this film, A Place at the Table, and it points you on their website to the Oregon Food Bank, which as a charity is certainly inadequate, but a good cause because people do need to keep eating even until we figure out larger and systemic solutions to these problems. So for The Old Mole, this has been Fran Michel and Denise Morris discussing A Place at the Table, currently playing at the Hollywood Theater.
And that's Marvin Gaye with Inner City Blues, Makes Me Wanna Holler. And we'll be hearing more soul music and talking with Brad Duncan in a few minutes about the politics of the 1960s and 70s soul music. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Well, next up on The Mole, I'm going to be talking with radical musicologist Brad Duncan about the music we've been playing. The last time our radical musicologist Brad Duncan talked with us, he talked about the beginnings of rock in the 1950s and how that was related to the civil rights movement. But as the 50s turned into the late 60s and the 70s, the civil rights movement, with its focus on integration and equal treatment by the law, morphed into a more assertive movement for black power, and this more assertive stance was reflected in the music. So today Brad is back to talk about the music that was touched by the ideas and the activism of black power. Hey, welcome to KBOO, Brad.
Hey, great to be here, as always.
Well, why don't you start by talking a little bit about the Black Power movement, where it came from, what its demands were, and then a little bit about how the music spoke for it.
Well, the term Black Power was coined by Stokely Carmichael, one of the organizers with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, in the summer of 1966, and really represents an increasing frustration and exasperation with the extremely slow rate of change coming from the civil rights movement, meaning the more integrationist strategy and approach to fighting for Black freedom in the South and nationwide was producing so little and was really radicalizing the grassroots of the movement. And so really the emergence of the Black Power movement really expresses that radicalization. It's a much deeper critique of the role of white supremacy in U.S. society and history than really what started as the civil rights movement in the mid-1950s, coming out of Brown versus Board of Education in that period that we talked about in our last segment. So if we can look at it as part of an arc, it really represents a radicalizing and a crystallizing of the movement in the Deep South. And musically, this movement found such important expression in the soul music of the 1960s. Soul music really being a kind of pop music that has its roots in gospel and R&B, and found really incredible expression in this music to the extent to which I would say that many people born since the 60s and early 70s who did not experience the movement back then, these songs are so much of how a younger generation remembers the Black Power movement. You know, songs by James Brown and Curtis Mayfield have played such a large role in keeping this radical late 60s and early 70s period alive in the consciousness of the public.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thought, because we tend to assume that our people's or our society's memory of these important events of the past have to be contained in history books. And so if students don't study these things and remember them, then they won't know them. But the music keeps it alive at a much more kind of gut level in people.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, when you take a song like What's Going On or Inner City Blues that Marvin Gaye released in 1970, I mean, as soon as people hear the opening chords of that song, yeah, all you can think about is the great social upheaval of the period. It's such an intrinsic connection to it. And while I've brought up that record, that Marvin Gaye record, I want to make a point that's important to think about when thinking about the civil rights and Black Power era and the expression that it found in pop music at the time. And that's this. It really took some time for mainstream for-profit record labels, the music industry more generally, to develop any kind of comfort with artists that were on its roster identifying with this movement. Meaning, even though the Black Power movement really crystallizes in the mid-60s, and of course that comes after 10 years of civil rights organizing, starting with the Montgomery bus boycott, it's really only in the late 60s that there's really a critical mass of hit singles that come out with this kind of explicit message, because it took that long for record labels to get over the fear of, say, a white backlash, say, being boycotted by DJs, or in other ways facing political suppression. And so it took that long, and really it's songs like People Get Ready by The Impressions, but Curtis Mayfield's Impressions, the great group from Chicago, defining a Northern soul sound.
People get ready, there's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on.
Or, you know, song Sam by Sam Cooke, really the iconic soul artist Sam Cooke, A Change Is Gonna Come. It took those songs breaking through the public consciousness and even the airwaves to slowly bring home the fact that this revolution was going to change pop music, really whether the record industry liked it or not.
Yeah. One of the songs that we played that has some of the deepest appeal in a very general way is that Nina Simone song, I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free.
Oh, what an absolutely beautiful song. And when it comes to expressing the politics of the civil rights and black power era, really in many ways almost no one does it as well as Nina Simone. And consistently throughout the 60s, and Nina Simone is in not a unique case, but an important case, because she was so willing to be associated with the movement and the message of the movement, even as it became more radical over the course of the 60s, really record labels and radio stations be damned. She was really extremely courageous from the beginning. She had a song that listeners, if you're not familiar with, need to get on YouTube, called, that's about Mississippi, called Mississippi Goddamn.
Oh, yeah.
Which is really one of the most incendiary, it really conjures what was happening with the movement in the Deep South in 1963, 64, 65. A powerful testament, really, in terms of original songwriters of the period, almost no one really captures it like Nina Simone. Right. And that song, that absolutely just lovely song, I think is, you know, gives powerful expression to that.
Well, Brad, we're running out of time for today, but this is Membership Drive here on KBOO, and could you say just a little bit to our listeners about why it's important that they should give us their money?
Oh, well, it's a no-brainer. There's two issues. One, the programming on KBOO is unlike any other station. I mean, truly unlike any other station. And then there's the mechanics of it. You know, we all know how a radio station does what it does, you know, down to keeping the lights on. So it's very simple. There's nothing else like it. And in a material sense, it needs resources to function. So listeners will do what's right.
They will. Thanks, Brad, very much. It's great to talk with you as always.
Yeah, we'll talk again soon for sure.
Okay, good.
The name of this tune is Mississippi Goddamn. I mean every word of it. Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi. Goddamn!
And that's the great Nina Simone with Mississippi Goddamn. So, and that's going to be it for The Mole today. Many thanks to Bill Resnick and Bob McChesney for their discussion of the struggle to control the Internet. To our movie moles, Fran Michel and Denise Morris, for their review of A Seat at the Table. To Brad Duncan for selecting and discussing today's music. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Joe Clement has been our engineer. The Old Mole will be back next Monday morning at 9, when Joe Clement will be hosting with more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's underground perspective.
Hound dogs on my trail, school children sitting in...